This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. This year, the first night of Hanukkah arrives on Christmas Eve. And while that overlap is rare, the two winter holidays actually have a good amount in common. This includes some borrowing from earlier pagan and Roman solstice celebrations. But these winter holidays themselves have evolved and changed. For example, in Puritan times, it was a crime to celebrate Christmas. And in the early 1900s in this country, many Jewish immigrants set aside Hanukkah and embraced a secular Christmas as a way to assimilate in America. Today in The Exchange, holiday tales and traditions. Let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at nhprexchange. We have three guests for the hour. Joining us by phone, Stephen Reno, a longtime professor of comparative religion. He's currently executive director of Leadership New Hampshire and former chancellor of the University System of New Hampshire. And Steve Reno, welcome back. Good to have you.
Thank you. Good morning.
With us in studio is Reverend Sally Newhall. She's pastor of Nashua Presbyterian Church and current vice president of the Nashua Interfaith Council. And Reverend Sally, nice to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Also with us, Rabbi John Spira Savette of Nashua's Temple Beth Abraham. He's past president of the Nashua Area Interfaith Council. And Rabbi John, good to have you too. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Rabbi John, I want to start with you. So a few years ago in this program, we talked about Thanksgivica when Hanukkah fell on Thanksgiving. Now the first night of the eight nights of Hanukkah falls on Christmas Eve. How does this happen?
Well, the reason it happens is because the Jewish holidays work on a lunar calendar, and our calendar is generally either 12 or 13 lunar months long. The months always begin with a new moon, and but unlike the Muslim calendar, which just sticks on a 12-month cycle and is shorter than the solar year, we correct it every two or three years. We add a month in the spring to make sure that the holidays occur in the seasons that they're associated with historically.
Okay, so the calendar that most people are operating on is the Gregorian calendar. Mm-hmm. Is that right? And that comes from the Muslim world?
No, no. The Muslims have a purely lunar calendar and of 12 lunar months, which is 10 or 11 days shorter than the solar year, which means their holidays go backwards during the solar calendar year.
I see. So you're operating on a lunar calendar, and that's why every year it's a little bit different. So a couple years ago, Hanukkah fell on Thanksgiving, and now it's falling on Christmas Eve.
Yes.
So what's the coincidence of that bringing to mind for you, Rabbi John, and I want to hear from everybody on this, from a religious or spiritual perspective?
You know, part of it is that the holidays are always sort of near each other. Hanukkah is always in the, at least the way we experience them here in the United States, are generally during the time when people are thinking about Christmas, and it's always the winter time. And one thing that I was just learning recently is that even though Hanukkah doesn't always occur right around exactly the winter solstice, because it's the 25th of the lunar month, it's always the darkest few days of the month, the time right before the moon disappears and the time when there's just the earliest moonlight. So and then, you know, we just the other thing is that just generally it makes us think a bit about our relationship to the culture that we're living in, which more people celebrating Christmas than Hanukkah.
Well, and I want to get back to you on that, too. But Steve Reno, to you as well, you know, never mind the whole thing about calendars and how they overlap and change. What about from that religious perspective or that spiritual perspective? What does it come up for you, the fact that these two holidays are really falling on the same day?
Well, I think it's also an illustration of the fact that human beings need festivals. There's a wonderful passage in Plato in the Laws where he says the gods took pity on mankind born to work and laid down a succession of recurring feasts to restore them from their fatigue so that they could, at the end, stand up again and work. So there's a need, it would appear, for us to step out of ordinary time occasionally and be refreshed in some way by festivals. And to follow on Rabbi John's point, the the winter solstice is the darkest time of the year. It's the transition from the shortest day to hopefully the longest day, and so it's a time to celebrate light and to express the hope for light, and so it's not surprising that this particular feast of Christmas, for example, is associated with the Natalis Invicti, the early Roman celebration, the Saturnalia, and becomes really an opportunity for people to step out of ordinary time and celebrate. And over the years and over the centuries, there have been some very impressive forms of celebration.
We'll talk about how those have evolved. We actually have on our website a picture of a public notice posted in Boston many, many years ago that says celebrations of Christmas are to be outlawed. I think they even call them, Reverend Sally, satanic observations, you know, no feasting, partying, drinking, and so forth. But what about Hanukkah and Christmas Eve, Reverend Sally, falling so close together? How do you sort of work that into the thoughts that you give to your congregation?
Well, the issue for me, it's actually Steve raised it, is that this is the darkest time of the year, and our faith is what gives us hope. And when we live in a dark time, it's the hope we're looking toward, and the celebration of light and the light of God in the world, that God can overcome the darkness, is a major Christian theme throughout the Christmas season. And I assume during Hanukkah as well, but I don't know if you associate the light of Hanukkah with the light of God.
Yeah, we do. It's interesting. If you read the Talmud, which are some of the early writings of Judaism, although they were written down after the Bible and after the story, the events of Hanukkah, there are two reflections you find about this season. One is that the same theme of the darkness and the summer solstice, and that the natural course of the world is to go through this cycle. And the other is the idea of Hanukkah as a time of human initiative, of a group of people who saw a dark time in their lives. In our case, it was a religious persecution, and took matters into their own hands, inspired by their hope and their story. And we really wrestle with both things. What's the role of receiving light, and what's the role of making light?
Giving light. And just quickly remind some people who may not know the actual story of Hanukkah, what the menorah and the 8 days and all that is all about.
Well, quickly, as quickly as I can.
Give us the 30-second story. Just kidding.
Sure. Hanukkah celebrates events that took place in the 2nd century BCE when the Jews were living in the empires that had been created really by Alexander the Great. And for most of that time, it was a fairly tolerant time where Jews were allowed to practice our own ways. But there was a particular king who rose up whose name was Antiochus, and he instituted a set of bans against Jewish practices, and also took over the temple in Jerusalem and set up pagan altars, altar to Zeus. And a group of priests who fled from Jerusalem to the countryside eventually led a rebellion. They came to be known as the Maccabees after their leader, Judah, who was called Maccabee. And after a few years, they won in their kind of guerrilla war against Antiochus, and they took over the temple and rededicated it. And they ended up bringing back a celebration for a week that had been delayed in the fall when the temple was under foreign control, the holiday of Sukkot, the festival of booths or tabernacles, and which was also the anniversary of when the temple had been built by King Solomon back in biblical times. So they rededicated it. They relit the lamps, which were part of there was a candelabrum, which was always burning in the temple and was relit every day. And they had other celebrations as well. And that became an annual thing. And much later on, the story of the candelabrum, the menorah itself, became very prominent. And it was part of the story of figuring out whether the heroes of the story were the Maccabees who led the successful revolt, or God who provided the miraculous light.
So every time I see a menorah, Reverend Sally, I think of the Advent candles that I grew up with. And every time I see Advent candles, I think, wait a minute, that's kind of stealing from a menorah. So what are some of the borrowing back and forth that you see among these two religions, especially at this time of year?
I have to admit, until we were actually working on this together, I hadn't thought about the similarities. But for me, the light of the candles also brings the idea of the light of the star, which at Christmas time, we're told that three magi, astrologers, saw an unusual star and followed it to Bethlehem. That star in the night was a symbol of the birth of the light of God. The Gospel of John talks about the light coming into the darkness and the darkness not putting it out. He talks about the birth of Jesus metaphorically that way. The other thing that hit me thinking about it was that not just the candles and the menorah being a similarity, but also that the 12 days of Christmas with the 8 days of Hanukkah, I kind of wondered how much borrowing was going on there as well, because I grew up in a tradition where we put up the Christmas tree on Christmas Eve and it stayed up till Epiphany.
Oh, interesting.
So we celebrated the 12 days of Christmas even more than focusing on Advent. Didn't get a gift every day, though. one of the articles you had sent us talked about the idea that perhaps Jesus celebrated Hanukkah, which frankly was a new idea to me. And I'm really curious to kind of explore with Rabbi John as to what you might know or not know about what might have been happening back when Jesus was a child. Might he have known about Hanukkah, or he certainly would have known about the Maccabees, but
we don't know so much, because I think if you look at some of the writings of that time, the writings of Josephus, who was a historian from that time, he mentions Hanukkah when he talks about its history, but he talks only a little bit and has even some uncertainties about how it's observed. And my sense is that Hanukkah became has been a bigger or smaller holiday depending on what's been going on around. And I don't think that we know how it was observed exactly in the time of Jesus.
Yeah, well, and a little bit later, we'll talk about how Hanukkah for some people has become the Jewish Christmas. And I definitely want to get your thoughts on that, Rabbi John. But Steve, we note to you, how much borrowing do you see among these two holidays?
Well, I think there's probably borrowing, but I would say it's because fundamentally both are festivals of light, and they celebrate light. In fact, it was Cyprian of Carthage, a 3rd century bishop, who first brought together, probably formally, the idea of the birth of the sun, S-U-N, with the birth of the sun, S-O-N. And the rise of the sun, which is really in some ways to traditional peoples still kind of a miraculous event, and then the birth of the sun, the Son of God, Jesus, is similarly, and it's interesting because both Hanukkah and Christmas have a dimension of their significance that has to do with the miraculous, the fact that the oil that was sufficient for one day was sufficient for the whole of eight, for the fact that the divine became incarnate in human form, again is miraculous. So there's a rootedness of both of these traditions in something that is miraculous. Something that is beyond the ordinary, and also that is celebrated and symbolized by light.
Again, the exchange number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. That's Steve Reno, former longtime professor of comparative religion, currently executive director of Leadership New Hampshire. Also with us, Reverend Sally Newhall, pastor of Nashua Presbyterian Church, and Rabbi John Spira-Savet of Nashua's Temple Beth Abraham. Again, the exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Since Christmas Eve and the start of Hanukkah fall on the same day this year, a rare aligning of the Gregorian and lunar calendars, we'd love your questions and comments about both of these holidays, their origins, the symbols they share, how they differ, how much they've borrowed from each other and from other traditions. Again, the number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at nhprexchange. Steve, another question for you. You talked about, the commonality of miracle, and everybody's talked a lot about the commonality of light at this darkest time of year. Another theme I came across yesterday that they may share in common, and I want to know what you think. The idea of rebellion, for example, for the Jews, a small group rising up against a big foe, the Maccabees fighting against their Syrian oppressors, who had a fantastic army, and the Maccabees were sort of
small band of rebels with, you know, sticks and stones, so to speak. And then for Christians, the idea that a poor Jewish girl, you know, named Mary, her real name might have been Miriam, some people say, since she was Jewish, living under Roman oppressors, could actually be the mother of the Savior. That's a pretty rebellious idea as well. So I just wonder, what about that theme, Steve Reno, of rebellion?
Well, I think you're absolutely right. You should have been a theologian, Laura. but seriously, the paradox of the supernatural, the fact that the simplest, the most humble, can ultimately be powerful, is really a very, very common theme across comparative religion. If I can switch cultures for just a moment and turn to the Chinese tradition of Taoism, that equates this theme with water. Water is as it runs down a hill, comes to stones or rocks and accommodates and goes around them, and yet over time it will wash those away. And so what seems to be supple and compliant is ultimately powerful, and that's the mystery of the supernatural. And I think we see that in both. Human beings could not have achieved these things on their own. There's some divine power that enables this to happen, and the same with overcoming sin. The birth of Jesus is an intrusion of the supernatural that offers an option of power that otherwise wouldn't be there. It's the mystery of the supernatural.
Let's go to our callers, all of you. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Nick joins us from Manchester. Hi, Nick. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
I'm curious if your guest could speak to the origin of the Christmas tree, the tree being a symbol of Christmas and bringing a tree into one's home. How did that tradition come about?
I love that question, Nick. Thank you so much. I think of that every single time I have to vacuum 3 times a day to get rid of the needles. Go ahead, Reverend Sally.
Well, I grew up, my dad came from a German family, so the tree is very important in our tradition because the use of the Christmas tree actually comes from our German origins, and the rest of us have borrowed it from it. In fact, it was when a Hanoverian king came to England, he brought the tree with him, and as the first tree went up, was that Victoria? But anyway, but at Christmas time, a great theological theme, of course, is eternal life, the gift of eternal life which we have in Jesus Christ. And the evergreen tree is obviously a sign of ever-living life because it doesn't die in the winter. So at winter time, at Christmas, when everything else has died, the evergreens are a symbol to us, as is the holly, of the life that continues, of the continuing life that we have, and the promise of eternal life that we have in the birth of Christ, which, of course, is fulfilled in Easter, in his resurrection.
So this reminds me of a bumper sticker that I've seen around, Reverend Sally, that says Christianity has pagan DNA. Some people say that the whole holly and evergreen comes from paganism.
Well, it's interesting. Christianity has gone either two ways as it's encountered new cultures as it spread. It has either tried to destroy the culture it encounters, as unfortunately we did in a lot of Africa, or it has sought to adapt to the culture and to find symbols within the culture that resonate with Christian beliefs. And this is one of the times where we did a good job of resonating with a symbol in the culture that was part of what we already believed, and we just said, well, look, you've already got the symbol. That's what we're talking about. And so, yes, we appropriated that symbol, but I think that's a good way of sharing our faith, not a bad way.
Okay, and it makes it easier for, you know, if early Christians want to convert pagans, it makes it easier. Look at all this similarity. This will be very comfortable for you. Great question, Nick. Thank you. We'll take a lot more in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at holiday tales and traditions. This year, Christmas Eve and the start of Hanukkah fall on the same day. It's a rare occurrence, and so we're using it to explore the customs and origins of these holidays, the symbols they share, how they differ, and how much they've borrowed from each other and from more ancient celebrations. Let's hear from you. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Whatever your faith tradition, however you observe either of these holidays, we'd love to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. You can respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR. Exchange. And Steve Reno, how about to you that same question that I asked Reverend Sally, that bumper sticker that I see, Christianity has pagan DNA.
Oh, I think it's great. It's a wonderful insight. It's true. And I think that Reverend Sally explained it very, very nicely. There's something wonderful about the fact that that even pagan and other traditions share certain human needs, certain human insights, if you will, certain human reactions. The perception of the tree, of the evergreen tree as a symbol of life and hope is it's wonderful. It's a commonality of humanity that I think infuses all religious traditions.
What about the date, Steve, December 25th? From what I've read, there's no evidence that's actually Jesus's birthday.
Well, you know, it's really fascinating, Laura. The scholarship on the date of Christmas is really voluminous.
There's a lot, yes.
It is. It really is. And it's probably not until about the late 3rd century, 4th century, early 4th century, that it becomes more fixed as the 25th. But it is very likely, and I think I mentioned Cyprian of Carthage earlier, the date was chosen in part because of the festivities of the Sol Invictus, the Natalis Invictus, the birth of the sun. It's a topic of great conversation for a long time.
You know, talking about pagan DNA, Rabbi John, does Hanukkah have any pagan DNA?
It's interesting that you asked that specifically about Hanukkah. There is a story in the Talmud that says that the celebrations and the observances at this time of year were originated by Adam in the Garden of Eden when he had his first winter and he saw the days getting shorter and began to worry that it was his fault, his punishment for the acts in the Garden of Eden, the rebellion actually against
getting
against
back God to that theme, right?
Getting, yeah. and then he noticed that the days naturally became longer, and the Talmud says he the next year, instead of fasting and then feasting, he just feasted the whole time. And
sounds like Christmas or Hanukkah. Yeah.
But what's interesting is that the Talmud essentially says that all religions have kind of human DNA, paganism, Judaism, and I suppose by extension Christianity, that they all respond to these same basic needs that Professor Reno was talking about and we've been talking about.
The need to take a break from the normal routine, the need to feast and celebrate with family, the need to worry about how dark it's getting and then say, hooray, it's getting lighter.
Yes.
So the bumper sticker should be changed. All religions have human DNA.
That would be particularly, I think, for our time, a great bumper sticker.
Again, the number here in the exchange for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Tanya joins us from Bedford. Hi, Tanya. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Go ahead.
My family is not Jewish. I am not Jewish, but we have been celebrating Hanukkah for well over a decade since my teenage children were little tots. And they absolutely love it. They can't wait to, like, get our menorah out and light the candles, and we say prayers, and we reflect upon the story of Hanukkah, and the meaning of it has evolved over the years for us personally as our children have grown. But we really look at it as a metaphorical lesson that you can learn from and that you can apply to your life.
So, Tanya, you are not Jewish, but you celebrate Hanukkah anyway because you think it's
yes.
a cool holiday. All right. Have you heard other people say this, Rabbi John?
You know, I have no idea how prevalent that is. It's fascinating and something I could think of only happening in a time like ours.
And in a country like this.
And in a country like ours. A couple weeks ago was the Hanukkah celebration at the White House, and it's become a tradition. And And President Obama himself talked about some of these very themes and what Hanukkah represents, both in terms of the resonance of the rebellion of the Maccabees with the American founders against a king, and the issue of religious freedom. And one of my favorite menorahs that I've ever seen actually was one that was created for the 100th anniversary of the Statue of Liberty in New York. And it's a menorah where each of the holders of the candles is the Statue of Liberty, so the flame of Liberty being merged with this. And it was created by a man named Manfred Anson, who was actually a survivor of the Holocaust, and he came to the United States and Jewish, but felt that there was such a resonance between these stories.
Well, thank you, Tanya, for the call. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Again, 1-800-892-6477. So, Steve Reno, I know you have to go soon. So, last question for you. Now Christmas is celebrated with great fanfare. It's not just a day. It's a whole season. And, you know, people sometimes complain about the shopping and the cooking and the endless this and that. Was it always this way in America, Steve?
No, it wasn't. In fact, there was the Puritans in this country. Of course, the Puritans in England before that felt that the day was so sacred that it was really a terrible thing to celebrate it with all of this eating and drinking and feasting and celebration and so on. And so it was banned. The singing of Christmas carols, the decorating of houses, the feasting, all of these kinds of things were seen to be, at least in England, evidence of popery of the Roman Church.
So it was more an anti-Catholic thing.
Absolutely. Well, anti-Catholic, but also objecting to the fact that there was no justification, it was felt, for these types of celebrations, that it was a sacred day and it should be observed in a somber way. And so it really is only relatively recently in our own country that all of these wonderful traditions that we enjoy today have become associated with Christmas.
Well, what sort of turned the tide for Christmas, Steve?
Well, I think over time, just the human instinct to do as we have talked about earlier, to celebrate this in a way that is more satisfying to human beings, and eventually the laws were changed in order to allow it. But it must have been a very, very somber time then, when we were all under these edicts.
Well, and who wants to be somber when it's so dark anyway?
Absolutely.
Maybe there's some natural push there.
Absolutely.
Well, Steve, thank you so much. Any last thoughts from you about Christmas, Hanukkah, and the confluence of these two holidays?
Well, I think it's wonderful. I'm really struck by the DNA bumper sticker that you talked about, Laura. I think it conveys a wonderful insight that despite the differences among religious traditions in detail, if one works down through the various layers of significance of the festivals that one is talking about, comparing, not comparing for the sake of saying one is better than another, but comparing in terms of details, if you work further down, I think you find a common bedrock of human need that they all respond to. And I think that's a very, very reassuring insight.
Again, the number in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Steve Reno, I'm sorry you have to go, but we will let you go at this point.
Thank you so much. And Merry Christmas to everyone and Happy Hanukkah.
Take care. Steve Reno, former longtime professor of comparative religion and former chancellor of the University System of New Hampshire. He's currently executive director of Leadership New Hampshire. Again, that number, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And you look like you want to jump in there too, Reverend Sally. The idea that, you know, early in our history, the Puritans called it a satanic celebration. I mean, again, we've got that poster up on our website from a long time ago.
Well, Christmas has been celebrated incredibly differently over the hundreds of years that it's been happening. And it, unfortunately, in England, about the time that the Puritans began to develop as a separate sect, there was riotous drunkenness, carousing. There was nothing religious at all about what was happening. And the Puritans, remember, didn't even like buttons. They didn't want anything that would look showy. And so they were very austere in their lifestyle as well as in their worshiping style. They could sing the Psalms, but they couldn't use musical instruments. They couldn't life was very simple. They couldn't sing other songs. So they were very strict in how they approached everything. And as a Presbyterian, I'm sort of one of their descendants from the Puritans. And the Presbyterians basically, our roots are Germanic and from Scotland. Scotland didn't actually make a Christmas holiday until 1967.
Really?
Because the Presbyterians didn't believe we should celebrate Christmas. And our root is that Easter is the heart of Christian faith, not Christmas. Christmas is important to us theologically because it points to Easter. If there had been no Easter, Christmas would not be important at all. And so to have that become the major holiday for us is uncomfortable. Yeah.
When you say us, you mean
many Christians.
Yeah, more conservative parts of Christianity. Conservative meaning coming from that Puritan tradition.
Sure, although I think of myself as a liberal Christian, but I hate to see Easter overshadowed by Christmas. And Christmas, particularly in this country, is not always religious. So that raises a whole other issue.
So in Europe earlier, before the Puritans or at the time of the Puritans, there were raucous drunken celebrations, and it was the Puritans who came to this country and kind of buttoned it down for a good amount of time.
And they buttoned it down in England as well, and particularly Scotland, sure. So, but back, it's interesting because Charles Dickens is one of the ones who was primarily effective in the mid-1800s with a Christmas carol, with lifting up the good aspects of Christmas and family and compassion and caring for your neighbor, and a whole new sense of Christmas that was family-oriented began to develop again. And so it's really from the mid-1800s that Christmas as we know it began to develop.
Well, and a little shameless plug here. Actually, on Saturday, we're going to broadcast once again my interview with Gerald Charles Dickens, who I always get the greats mixed up. I think it's great, great, great grandson of Charles Dickens. And we did a wonderful interview several years ago. And you're right. People credit Charles Dickens with reviving the whole idea of Christmas cheer and charity. So mm-hmm. Let's go back to our listeners. And Joyce is waiting in Somersworth. Hi, Joyce. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Good morning. Thanks for the great program. I wanted to comment about a question that you raised earlier as to whether Jesus knew or celebrated Hanukkah. We don't know much about his celebration, but we do have the direct quote in the Gospel of John, chapter 10, verses 22 and 23, citing that it was Jerusalem, and it was the Feast of Dedication, which is another word for Hanukkah, and that it was winter, and that he walked in the temple in Solomon's portico. So it's extremely specific, and we do know that he was at least praying during that time.
Wow, Joyce, you got some religious scholarship going on there too, huh?
I study.
Well, go ahead, Rabbi John, then I have another question for you.
No, I learned something which I didn't know. Thank you for that. And you're right, for the listeners, the word Hanukkah means dedication, referring to the rededication of the temple back in the time of the Maccabees. And it actually furnishes some evidence because I didn't know before whether that was the common name of the holiday, which I know was referred to at times as the Festival of Light.
And we do know that Jesus celebrated Passover, which is a hugely important holiday for Jews, because the Last Supper was a Passover Seder. Is that correct, Rabbi John, or am I stretching it here?
Actually, this is a topic of something that Sally and I taught a whole a class down in the community about exploring exactly what it was, and I should defer to her.
Well, yes, probably by tradition, but actual biblical scholars who get into tearing it apart then debate whether it was actually Passover or not. But by tradition, the scriptures do say that they were celebrating the Passover meal together when they had the Last Supper. Also, they celebrated Pentecost. And Pentecost is the third major Christian holiday. So we've got Christmas and Easter, which corresponds with Passover, and then Pentecost. We borrow from... That's not borrow. We inherited because we see our roots within Judaism. So,
let's take another call. Joyce, thank you so much for that one. And Carlos is joining us from where? Hi, Carlos. Go ahead.
Hi. First of all, Rabbi John, it's very good to hear you again.
Thank you.
I haven't been to temple in a while because I moved out of the area. but at any rate, my understanding of the 8 days, the reason for the 8 days of the celebration is that when the Maccabeans took back over the temple, they only had one cruse of oil, which was a measure of 1 day's worth of light. And it took them 8 days to make more oil, but that one cruse of oil lasted 8 days and not just the one that it would have normally have lasted.
Right, and that's the miracle, Carlos.
Right.
Yeah. Go ahead, Rabbi John. So he's correct on that, isn't he?
Yes, and I would say the original sources don't mention the miracle of the oil for hundreds of years. They refer, as I was saying before, to a kind of rescheduling of the Festival of Booths, the holiday of Sukkot, which is 8 days celebrated in the fall right after the Jewish New Year, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. And since they were unable to celebrate it at its time, they decided to celebrate it on the anniversary of the original desecration of the temple. And that was really the original source for the 8 days. And
wait, I'm a little confused. Yeah. I've heard this 8 days miracle for a long, long, long time. So the actual 8 day thing isn't around Hanukkah. It's about earlier holidays in the fall.
Yes. Yes. And I think what happened later was that, again, as part of this reinterpretation of Hanukkah within the Jewish tradition, there came about this retelling of a story, which I think was an earlier story that existed about a miraculous discovery of some oil that had been hidden away in a book in the Apocrypha near the Bible. That's preserved in some of the Christian scriptures called Second Maccabees. They tell a story of from a few hundred years before the events of Hanukkah when this temple had been originally built, the second temple, that the priests had discovered hidden away for them some oil or some kind of material to get the sacrifices started again. And in that sense, I think that it's not just the miracle of the oil, but the miracle that somebody had the forethought to, in a dark time, store away some light for the future for someone else to discover and to uncover.
Got it. That's the first time I've ever heard that story. Well, and it gets to something that we should talk more about. Reverend Sally talked about how Christmas has been reinterpreted, especially when white Europeans started settling this country. We should talk about how Hanukkah got sort of reinvented by American Jewish immigrants who wanted to assimilate.
Yeah, and I think that Hanukkah, I don't really know exactly how prevalent it was in Europe in the time before the big immigration. The largest immigration of Jews to the United States was in the late 1800s and the early 1900s. And I've just been reading from a book by actually a guest you had on a previous Hanukkah time, talking about how Hanukkah was sort of re-energized by some of the Jewish leaders here as a way of giving Jewish children especially something to do and to be proud of that wasn't the observance of and celebration of Christmas.
We'll talk about that a little bit more after a short break. And you can join us too, 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, holiday tales and traditions with Christmas Eve and the first night of Hanukkah falling on the same day this year, a rare calendar alignment. So we're taking the opportunity to explore the customs, origins of these holidays, the themes they share, the symbols they share, how they differ, and how they've evolved in this country. Let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. nhpr.org. You can respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. With us in studio, Reverend Sally Newhall. She's pastor of Nashua Presbyterian Church. Also with us, Rabbi John Spira-Savet of Nashua's Temple Beth Abraham. And Rabbi John, just before the break, we were talking about how, you know, Jews in this country, they came in as immigrants, you know, 100 or so years ago, a little bit more, and really wanted to assimilate. So how did Hanukkah help them do that?
Yeah, and I want to say by way of preface to that that when I teach adults about Hanukkah, I talk about the persecution and the rebellion of Hanukkah as being part of the same world where the Jews also translated the Torah into Greek. There was this real tug. And in fact, these original stories of Hanukkah talk about there being a group of allies to Antiochus who really wanted to give up Judaism and bring themselves over to Hellenistic ways.
And again, Antiochus is the bad king who tried to oppress the Jews.
And so I think actually this tension of who we are and where we belong was built into the origins of Hanukkah. And it's not just a modern thing. And so I think what happened really is that in some ways, if I understand this right, that the prevalence and celebration of Christmas and of Hanukkah in this country sort of came about around the same time. And so I think some of the customs like gift giving is certainly not an original Jewish custom. You'd never see that until Jews became part of the culture where people were giving gifts around Christmas. And in fact, gift giving is associated with other Jewish holidays, with the holiday of Purim in the spring. And so I think there was always this tug over the last 100 years or so of trying to create a Hanukkah celebration that would be both authentic to the story, but also have enough bells and whistles to to help especially Jewish children feel that they had something this time of year that was special, and so that families didn't feel that they had to observe Christmas in some way, maybe some secular Americanized way.
So how do you feel, Rabbi John, when people say, oh, Hanukkah, that's Christmas for Jews?
Well, I think there's both. It's both and. I think I know that for myself, I went through a phase where I thought, well, Hanukkah is not one of the most important Jewish festivals, as Sally was saying.
Sure. From a purely religious standpoint, it's not as important as, you know, other high holy days.
But now I've come to see that that's because of its own message and its own story. And also because it relates to so much of our relationship with the people around us, that it's really important to have a celebration here. So I don't like to think of Hanukkah as the Jewish Christmas, but I like to think of it as the thing that Jews do around the time when people around us are celebrating Christmas.
I did a bunch of reading from various rabbis yesterday, again, to prepare for today's show. And some of them said, you know, early on they felt like most rabbis, you know, look, from a purely religious standpoint, Hanukkah's not that important. We have to conflate it because we're part of this broader American culture, but we feel a little uncomfortable. Now, though, some rabbis seem to be saying kind of what you said, Rabbi John, that, no, this is good. This is a chance for the broader culture to hear about our religion and our story, but also the idea that there are some good themes in here, you know, pride in that band of rebels and the miracle that they were able to persevere, even though, as I just learned from you a couple minutes ago, the miracle of the oil is a little not quite what I understood it. So I just wonder if you think that there's been this sort of evolution and then an evolution again in terms of how Jewish people think about the usefulness of Hanukkah.
Yeah, and I think it's all those different kinds of reactions. And I would add one more, which I say with my friend Sally, which is that the opportunity to experience some of the same deep human themes and deep religious themes, usually Hanukkah first, and then on Christmas, is certainly for me a chance to reflect on the beauty and the depth of those stories as they're told in two different ways. And I know it's enriching for me. And as someone who's Jewish and a minority and who has Jewish children who are growing up in a very Christmas-decorated environment, I really talk to their teachers about how I want them to really know what Christmas is about and not just to know about the fun parts of Christmas.
So you do have three children. Yes.
Yes,
so was that a struggle for them growing up, or did you just say, this is not what we do? Did they sort of look at the Christmas trees and in other kids' houses and drool with envy?
No. You know, each family is different and each child is different. And but for many Jewish children, I know certainly in New Hampshire where there might be one or two in every class or grade in a school, it does call on them sometimes to be a spokesman at a young age and very often to just try to figure out their own identity. the distinct identity and then what it means to be part of a large American identity together with other people.
Again, the phone number here in the exchange for you to join us with your questions and comments about these two holidays and maybe the fact that they're occurring pretty much together this year is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Again, that number, 1-800-892-6477. Reverend Sally, go ahead, jump in.
I just wanted to follow up on what Rabbi John said, because I think Christians are having the same struggle. Christmas has been taken over commercially, so that my children and my grandchildren, it's a struggle to help them remember what Christmas is about theologically, that it's not about Santa, it's not about gifts. It is about those things, but that's not where we're coming from as a church. And so I want my children and grandchildren to know the story of Christmas and the meaning of Christmas from a Christian perspective, but it gets lost in what's happening around us everywhere, frankly.
Is it upsetting to you to see all the, you know, commercialism and so forth? How do you sort of navigate that, given how you feel about the importance of this from a spiritual perspective?
Well, I love Christmas. I'm a Christmas kid. I love giving gifts. I just love it. And I love the decorations and I love all the traditions and the songs. But I started a new tradition in my family, and my kids are small, and I've kept it up with my grandkids, and that is every Sunday during Advent, and maybe I borrowed this from Hanukkah, I don't know, I give them a gift that helps them prepare. So it might be a story, a Christmas story. It might be something for their home, a decoration that reminds them of the religious significance, an Advent calendar, something that keeps them on the mark, remembering, because as everything else blasts them during December, I want to keep raising in a fun way the heart of what it's about.
Blast is a really good verb to use. I did some Christmas shopping yesterday and I did not. I came home and I was just wiped out. So a gift every Advent Sunday, but a gift that has a more theological meaning to it. Again, the number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Here's another email that just came in. This person, Sheila, says, thanks for this show. Another similarity, by the way, Sheila says, Christmas and Hanukkah is knowing that there are angels in each religious tradition. Now, Rabbi John, are there angels in the Jewish tradition? I know there certainly are in, they play a big role at Christmas, for example, in the Christian tradition.
That's a complicated question, and so I'll give you one Jewish answer, which is that there are angels really more in the imagination as kind of part of the the folklore, but we don't believe that literally there are angels, that we don't believe there's anything other than God who is in the spiritual realm, except for us who are also part of the spiritual realm.
So not necessarily beautiful beings with lovely robes and wings and coming in at the right time to tell you what to do.
I would say metaphorically and in stories, but not concretely and literally.
Well, Sheila, thank you. Sounds like you have a lot more to say there, but we're setting it aside for the moment. And let's go back to our phones. And Marzia calling from Fremont? Do I have that name right?
It's Marzia.
Okay. Go ahead. Thanks for calling in.
I'm calling because I grew up as a Seventh-day Baptist, and we didn't celebrate Christmas whatsoever because they thought that Christmas was more of a pagan religion. It wasn't actually based on Christianity, true Christ from the Bible. And it was kind of hard growing up as a small child, and everybody else around you celebrated Christmas.
Absolutely.
But it also made you understand Christmas a lot more than the actual people who celebrate Christmas. I celebrate Christmas now because of my husband, but my children understand more about Christmas than most people do. They know what the Christmas tree stands for. They know why the rings, and it's amazing how people celebrate and don't actually look into the history of it and actually know what all the symbols stand for and where they come from.
So how did you work through that as a child?
One, my older brothers helped us because my parents were from Jamaica, and the era that they lived in, there was more Seventh-day Baptist. So my older brothers grew up with other people not celebrating it. But when we went to London, it was just me and my two sisters, who were the youngest ones, who grew up not celebrating. So they kind of bought maybe little toys, very small toys for us, and just gave us one thing so that when we get to school, we could say, oh, we got this. But then, but we also did tell them we didn't celebrate Christmas. And even now, I don't really go and buy loads of toys for my children, because I believe that you should be at church on Christmas Day and that you should look at it as what it's supposed to be. It's about the religion, about the love of Christ. And I believe that Easter is the most important celebration.
Well, sort of what you said earlier, Reverend Sally, thank you so much for that call. And it's worth noting, Reverend Sally, that there are some groups that don't, Christian groups, that still have a really hard time with Christmas.
And it's because theologically, Christmas has just gotten so blown up in our society. Our children can tell you the Christmas story, even if they haven't been paying attention in Sunday school, but they can't tell us the Easter story. I get teenagers in a confirmation class who know the Christmas story by heart and the shepherds and the angels. In fact, people who aren't even Christians can tell you that from singing Christmas carols, but they can't tell you what happened at Easter time, who killed Christ, why, what happened 3 days later when the answer is he was raised from the dead, but most people don't know that. They don't pay attention. We do pageants at Christmas time. We don't do pageants at Easter time. It's just not part of our DNA. And so, so a lot of people just don't know the Easter story, and they don't understand the relationship between Christmas and Easter.
So what happened? How did Easter, which you and others have argued is actually the more important holiday from a religious perspective, how did it get sort of downgraded? And who downgraded it?
Well, I'm not sure it's downgrading. I frankly think it's the U.S. culture that's now spread around the world, but it's the commercialism, really. I mean, sure there was a carousing back in the 1700s, but people like feasts. That I think the time of the year, that's part of the culture. But we just put all of our energy, and it takes like 2 months for us to celebrate Christmas in the United States. I went into the store on Halloween Day, and they had the East Christmas decorations up on Halloween Day. We spend 2 months celebrating it, but in our culture, outside the church, you don't see any celebration of Easter. It's just, there's no money in it. There's no money in it.
Thank you again for that call. Let's go to Paul in Pittsfield. Hi, Paul. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm enjoying the show, and I want to point out that in your earlier discussion about Christmas and what the Puritans brought to this country, was very much an Anglophone narrative. And I want to remind you that contemporaneously with the Puritans in what's now the United States, there were French and Spanish colonists or colonizers who were bringing their own traditions, which were different than the Puritans.
Right. Here in New England, we focus mostly on the Puritans. But you're right. They were French and Spanish.
Well, not just that, but the Anglicans who were down in Virginia and so on, they continued to celebrate Christmas, while the Puritans weren't up here in New England. So you're right. We were taking a purely puritanical point of view on that one.
Well, and can I guess that the French and the Spanish probably were more into celebrating Christmas than because they were Catholic than the Puritans?
I don't know enough to comment on that, because Christmas was not universally celebrated as a big feast throughout even Europe. So I don't know at the time that those immigrants came here whether that was a big part of their tradition or not.
Okay. Well, thank you for the call, Paul. And here's an email from Chris in Bow. He says, in the Northern Hemisphere, where most of these religions took hold, the autumn into early winter is the end of the harvest, and it would be natural to feast and have a festival. And, of course, the Christians move quickly into Lent, a time of shortage. Chris says these are all parts of the Celtic Gaelic tradition and were drawn into the Christian tradition. Think about Halloween, the first holiday of the autumn, and getting food from the neighbors. Chris, thank you for that email. You can send us an email as well. It's exchange@nhpr.org, or respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And one more call for both of you. Terry is in Concord. Hi, Terry. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
morning. This may have been covered already. My understanding is that Christmas and all the trappings of Christmas, the Yule log, the trees, the decoration, the gifts, and so forth, are really from the pagan tradition, and that Jesus wasn't even born at this time of year. He was born at a completely different time of year. Can anybody comment about that?
Yeah, we did talk about that. In fact, I referred a couple times to a bumper sticker that I've seen that says Christianity has pagan DNA. Although I'm glad you called, Terry, because one thing that we didn't talk about is Santa Claus. Who the heck is he? Where does he come from? Why is he part of this?
Well, actually, there was a man. His name was Nicholas. He became the Bishop of Myra, lived back in the 4th century, and was noted for his generosity. There's a wonderful story. He was a rich man who became a priest, and he took some of his riches and would secretly gift people. There's a wonderful story about three young women who had a very poor father, so there was no dowry, and no dowry meant no wedding. And miraculously, during the night, someone would throw a bag of gold coins through the window, and first the elder daughter married, then the second daughter married, and then the third daughter married, all because of this miraculous coins. And later it became known that Nicholas had done this, and so other rich people began to give Nicholas money that he could distribute.
Oh, so Saint Nick, there he is.
There he is. His name changed, so Sinterklaas. They took Saint Nicholas. He became a saint, and so he was called Saint Nicholas or Saint Nick. And the Dutch called him Sinterklaas, Santa Claus from Sinterklaas, when the Dutch brought that to this country. Yeah.
Okay. Well, and Rabbi John, Hanukkah starts again December 24th, and then goes for 8 nights. What's the main message you're going to give to people?
Well, I think it's going to be all the things that we talked about, a message of hope in the things that we see and the things that we can't see, the responsibility to live as rebels and to live authentically in the society that we're in, and to see in one another the great light that is sometimes small and becomes large.
This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.